Paul's second letter to the church in Corinth, chapter 11. You'll remember that chapters 11 and 12 are dealing with a single subject. In these two chapters, Paul warns the Christians who make up the church in Corinth about a group of false teachers who have come to Corinth and have made a great impression on the church there. These teachers called themselves Christians. In fact, they claimed that they were apostles sent by Christ. They preached about Jesus. But as Paul says in verse 4, the Jesus they proclaimed was another Jesus, a different Jesus from the Jesus that Paul proclaimed. They encouraged Christians to receive the Spirit, but the Spirit that people received through them was a very different Spirit from the Holy Spirit. They preached a gospel, a message which they said was good news, but it was different from the true gospel. It was different from the good news that God had entrusted to Paul and the other genuine apostles. These fake Christians, these false apostles, had tried, and to a great extent they had succeeded, in driving a wedge between Paul, the man who planted the church in Corinth, and the Christians who made up that church. They'd criticized Paul relentlessly. They'd sneered at him. They'd undermined him. They'd made the Corinthians feel a bit embarrassed and ashamed to have links with Paul. So in these chapters, chapters 11 and 12, Paul's got to do two things. First, he's got to show the Christians in Corinth that these false teachers who had wormed their way into the church weren't to be trusted. And second, Paul's got to try to defend himself. He's got to try to win back the trust that the Corinthian Christians had once given him, but which they'd lost through the influence of these false teachers who had come along and criticized him. Now, in this chapter so far, we've seen two things that the false teachers had criticized about Paul. First, we've seen that they sneered at him and said that he didn't have the skill that they had as a speaker. What they meant by that was that when he spoke, when he was preaching or teaching, he didn't do it in the way that was fashionable. There were people who were considered experts in public speaking, and they'd worked out lots of techniques and tricks for public speakers to use. And if you wanted to be considered as a skilled speaker, well, you had to do it their way. And Paul didn't. Paul just spoke. He just spoke without any tricks, without any special technique. He spelled things out as simply as he could. He told people what they needed to hear. So these false teachers said, just listen to him. He's got no education. He just talks like any pleb. Well, what was Paul's reply to that? We saw it in verse 5. He says this, verse 6, even if I am unskilled in speaking, I am not so in knowledge. Indeed, in every way, we have made this plain to you in all things. Paul says, well, I may not show off any special skills when I'm talking, but at least I know what I'm talking about. And I've proved it again and again. When Paul spoke, it was obvious that he was speaking out of real knowledge. And then the second thing that the false teachers used to attack Paul was this. They used the fact that he didn't charge any fees for his preaching and teaching. In fact, he didn't accept any financial help from the Christians in Corinth at all. Whereas they, the false teachers, were ready to milk their hearers of every penny they could get out of them. Now, we talked last week about how and why that could be used against Paul. It may seem strange that a Christian leader should be attacked for not taking money from people. In our culture, you're much more likely to hear the opposite. Religious leaders are often attacked because they are taking money from people. So why did Paul get criticized for not taking money from the Corinthians? Well, I suggested three reasons. The first reason was this: because it meant that when he arrived in Corinth, Paul had to support himself. And the way that Paul did it was by working at a very low-grade job. Paul worked as a tent maker, making tents out of animal skins. Now, that wasn't the sort of job most people would have wanted or accepted. People in a city like Corinth thought it was humiliating to be a manual worker. And of all the jobs that manual workers did, that one would be right down at the bottom of the pile. So the false teachers were able to point to Paul and say, well, what sort of leader is he for a church? He's not only uneducated. Remember, when he was with you, he worked in a stinking tent factory. If he were really God's messenger, would he really be working in a place like that? If he were really God's ambassador, would he be doing a job like that? Aren't you embarrassed to be following someone like that? To be treating someone like that as your great teacher? Well, how does Paul respond to that? He responds to it in verse 7. Did I commit a sin in humbling myself? In humiliating myself? Yes, it was a humiliating thing for Paul that the one-time brilliant young rabbi, Gamaliel's favourite pupil, it was a humiliating thing for him to be seen doing that sort of low-grade job. But Paul says, remember why I did it. I humbled myself so that you could be exalted. I preached God's gospel to you free of charge. When I arrived in Corinth without any funds, I was willing to take any job I could find so that I could preach the gospel to you without asking you to pay for the privilege of hearing it. I humbled myself so that you could be exalted, so that you could hear the good news and be saved and become children of God. It's not a crime, is it, to sacrifice yourself for other people? Paul says, I sacrificed myself for you. I accepted the humiliation and the long hours and the exhaustion and the low pay that came with that job, just so that I could preach the good news to you. And never charge you a penny for it. That's his answer to their first criticism about his policy of not taking money from them. The second way in which the false teachers could sneer at Paul for not accepting any money from the Corinthians was that they could say, well, it just shows that what he's got to offer isn't worth very much. If he really thought that his teaching was important, he'd charge a proper price for it. Now, how does Paul respond to that? Well, he does it in a single phrase in the verse that we've already looked at, verse 7. Paul says, I preached God's gospel to you free of charge. Here are the false teachers sneering at Paul. Third-rate teaching from a third-rate teacher. Paul says, what I teach is God's gospel. God's great announcement of good news. What a devastating answer to the sneers of the false teachers. Paul says, what I'm bringing people isn't just a course of instruction. What I'm bringing people is the gospel. Now let me just try to unpack why that is such a powerful reply. The word that's translated gospel, often people say it means good news. But that's not quite it. The word doesn't just mean good news. It means an announcement, a proclamation, a declaration of good news. It's got the same root as the word for a messenger. When you come across the word gospel, euangelion, in the New Testament, you're supposed to have the picture in your mind of a messenger carrying news, good news. News that maybe there's been a great victory in battle, or maybe there's a new king on the throne, or maybe an usurper has been overthrown. Whatever it may be, there's only one way that the message can reach the people that need to hear it. Someone has to carry it. Maybe he goes on foot, maybe he goes on horseback, but he carries it as swiftly as he can. He carries it over every obstacle, he carries it mile after mile. And when finally he arrives at the destination, he blows a trumpet or in some other way catches the attention of everyone, and people gather all around him, and he shouts, I bring good news! The king has sent me to proclaim to you that... And then he brings out his good news, his happy message, whatever it may be. Now that's the picture you've got to have in your mind every time you come across the word gospel in the New Testament. The messenger sent by his master or sent by the king announces some great piece of news. If you want to feel the excitement that's there in the picture, read Robert Browning's poem, How They Brought the Good News from Aix to Ghent. And that poem captures the tremendous drama of the messenger who just rides on through every obstacle because he's got good news, the good news that can save the city. And he rides his horse into the ground to bring it. That's built into the word gospel. It's the announcement of good news by a messenger. Now, who pays the messenger to bring the good news? When the king sends out a messenger to proclaim good news to a city or to another country, who pays the messenger? Is it the people who listen at the other end? No, of course it's not. And the messenger doesn't arrive at his destination, call a crowd together, and then say, right, queue up, pay me £5, and I'll whisper the good news into your ear. Oh, he stands there and sounds it out for everyone to hear. And he's paid by the person who sent him. Now, who has sent Paul? Who has given Paul that message to deliver? Paul says, I preached God's gospel to you. Paul really does believe that God has sent him, that it's God who's given him this message to carry. And that makes the message supremely important. The message that Paul brought to Corinth wasn't just a few thoughts cobbled together by some philosopher or pundit. No, God himself had entrusted this message to Paul. Paul, this is the message. This is the good news that I want you to take to the world. That was God's command to Paul. Go, deliver it to people everywhere. Take it to Lystra, take it to Derbe, take it to Thessalonica, take it to Philippi, take it to Corinth and announce it there. The false teachers, they were sneering at Paul. They were saying, oh, if he really thought his teaching was important, He'd be charging fees to anyone who wanted to listen to it. Paul's answer is simple. I'll tell you how important my teaching is. It's a message given to me by God himself. A message which God wants the world to hear. A message which God has sent me to announce in Corinth. And when a king sends a message to his subjects, he doesn't charge them to hear it. It's far too important for that. Paul's saying, how could I ever charge people to hear the gospel when it's God who's commanded me to tell it to every one of them? The gospel. God's announcement of good news, which he sends to the world through his messengers. What good news it is! What good news Paul had to announce! What amazing good news we have to announce. This is the announcement. God has sent his own Son into the world to rescue lost people, guilty people. God has sent his own Son to save sinners. God's Son, Jesus, has come. And he's taken the punishment that we deserve. God's Son has suffered and died on the cross in the place of all who believe in him. And now God invites every man, woman, child on this planet, whoever they are, whatever they've done, to come back to him through Jesus Christ. And God promises to pardon you if you surrender to him now. God promises to love you, to keep you safe, to give you everlasting life. And you don't have to do anything to make up for the past. And you don't have to change yourself. And you don't have to turn your life around. And you don't have to make yourself into a different sort of person. You just believe in Jesus. And you turn to God and you throw yourself on his mercy. And through Jesus, God does it all. He'll give you a new start. He'll wipe out the past. He'll give you a new heart. Make you into a different sort of person, and it's all for free. So come now. That's the great announcement. That's the gospel. That's the message that God entrusted to Paul. Important? It's not just important, it's the only message that really matters. It's the only message that can save a single person. You know, you think of all the announcements, all the books, all the articles, all the lectures, all the essays that are written and published and sent and listened to every year, every week, every day. Thousands of people writing millions of words, telling people that what the authors think are important. In newspapers and in magazines and in universities and in colleges and in schools and on the internet and on the radio. There's an endless torrent of information for you to learn. And there's endless advice to take on board. An endless analysis of what's going on for you to drink in. And some of it is very intelligent and some of it is very perceptive and some of it is the result of many years of study. And yet in all that torrent of words, there isn't anything that can change a bad man into a good man. There isn't anything that can rescue a person from guilt. There isn't anything that can give a man or a woman peace with God. There isn't anything that can rescue a person from the power of death. But this simple message, this gospel, can do all those things. And a minute ago I summed up the gospel in a dozen sentences. Perhaps I made it too complicated. I can sum it up more briefly than that. You're a sinner. You're lost. But Jesus Christ has come into the world for lost sinners. He's come to die for them. Believe in him. Come back to God through him. God will pardon you. God will save you. God will give you everlasting life. A man, a woman, or a child who hears that message and who believes it and who acts on it in a moment is safe forever. They're rescued. In a moment, their sins are as if they'd never happened. And their heart is changed. And they're at peace with God. And they've got everlasting life. They're not just promised everlasting life. Their everlasting life has begun. Nothing else that human beings say or write can put a person right with God. But this one message can do it in a moment and can do it for anyone. That's how important the gospel is. How could Paul ever charge people for the opportunity to listen to the gospel? You know, imagine a king sends his servant into a town where famine is raging. And he gives the servant wagon loads of food to distribute to the starving people there. But when he gets to the town, the servant says, "No one gets any of this food unless he pays me up front for bringing it." What would you say of such a man? What would the king say when he heard of such a man? We have a message that is utterly priceless. The reason we can't, the reason we won't charge anyone for it isn't because it's worthless. It's because it's God's gospel, not ours. And he said to us, "Freely you've received, freely give." Let's move on. Paul was criticized for refusing to accept any money from people in Corinth. And I said that there were three ways that the false teachers used that against him. Firstly, they said it was humiliating for Paul himself and for the Corinthians who followed him. Secondly, they said it proved that Paul himself knew that his teaching wasn't worth anything. And number three, they said that it proved that Paul didn't really care about the Corinthians. Now, from our point of view, that may seem the most bizarre accusation of all. Paul preached the gospel to the Corinthians for free. Paul helped them, Paul served them, Paul gave 3 years of his life to discipling them. And that proves he didn't care about them. Yeah, it was bizarre. But you can see some logic in it. You know, many of us would be reluctant to take money or practical help from most people. But we might accept it from a close friend. Or from a family member. What the false teachers were saying to the Corinthian Christians was this: Paul obviously doesn't think of you as his friends, otherwise he'd have accepted your help. In the ancient world, in the world of Greece and Rome, there were definite protocols about who you'd accept money from. Wealthy people very often acted as patrons for poorer people. So if, let's say, you were a poet, well, there was no way you could support yourself by writing poetry. There was no printing press, there were no copyright laws. So you can't market your poems. So how do you live? Well, some wealthy man takes the poet under his wing. He offers to finance the poet. And the poet accepts his money. The wealthy man has become his patron. And the poet shows his respect and his affection. his love for his patron by taking the money. He's honouring his patron by accepting his money. It happened all the time when a master set his slave free. The slave normally didn't go off and live an independent life as a freedman. His old master continued to be his patron. So the ex-master would subsidize the ex-slave. He'd help him in all sorts of practical ways. The ex-slave would be known as his client. And to be somebody's client meant that you were part of his extended household. And as a member of the household, the client would be expected to show gratitude and love for his patron. You honoured your patron by taking his money. It brought public honour to a wealthy man if he could say, well, I'm patron to 100 clients. Now, there were some wealthy people in the church in Corinth. And those wealthy people would certainly have had some clients already. There would have been people in Corinth, poorer people, who would have thought of those wealthy people as their patron. And these wealthy people in the church would have been more than willing to become Paul's patron when he was in Corinth. And it will have riled them when he refused to accept that status, when he refused to have that sort of relationship with them. Now, that's what the false teachers were taking advantage of. They were saying, look, Paul pretends he cares about you. But Paul wasn't willing to have you as his patrons. Paul was too proud for that. Paul wasn't willing to live as a member in any of your households. Paul never really felt any respect or love for you at all. He was determined not to be linked to you in that way. If Paul had had any real affection for you, Paul would have swallowed his pride and he'd have accepted your patronage. That's the third accusation that Paul has to answer in this paragraph from verse 7 to verse 12. The fact that he didn't accept their money and that he didn't accept the status of a client to their patronage proves that he wanted there to be a cold, distant relationship between them. Well, how does Paul answer their accusation? Read on from verse 8. Paul says, I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. In verse 7, he said that he was willing to humiliate himself in order to preach the gospel to the Corinthians without charge. And I pointed out that one way he did that was by being willing to work as a despised tent maker. Now Paul mentions another aspect of his humiliation. Paul did something he hated doing. He robbed, the word really means he plundered, other churches. He's talking about the churches in Macedonia, the churches in Thessalonica and Berea and Philippi. It was from there, from that area, Macedonia, that Paul came to Corinth. Now, the thing to remember about those Macedonian churches is that they were desperately poor. And yet, when Paul left Macedonia to come to Corinth, those churches pressed money on him. Money they couldn't afford to give him. They gave it to him so that he could have money to live on when he arrived in Corinth and started preaching the gospel. And he took it. He felt terrible about it. It made him feel like a thief. He felt he was robbing them. But he took it, he says, in order to serve you. You say, Paul is talking to the Corinthians, you say that I'm too proud to accept your help. The fact is, I was willing to become a robber for you. Far from being too proud to accept help, I took money from those poor Macedonians just so that I could serve you. We'll come back in a moment to the question of why Paul was willing to accept help from the Macedonians but not the Corinthians. But for the moment, we just need to get the main point. Paul had done something that he hated doing, something that he would have found terribly humiliating. He'd accepted help from the very poorest churches, and he'd done so because he wanted to come to Corinth and serve people there. So much for the accusation that he didn't care about people in Corinth. He was willing to humiliate himself without reserve for their sake. He goes on, verse 9, "And when I was with you and was in need, I did not burden anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied my need." There came a point after Paul arrived in Corinth when he was in real need. The money he had brought with him from the Macedonians had run out. The money he was making so intense wasn't enough to live on. But even then, Paul didn't go to anyone in Corinth and ask for help. He went in need. He was hungry. Until Timothy and Silas, his co-workers who had stayed behind in Macedonia, until they turned up and brought money for Paul to live on. But Paul says again, you don't have to take that as a sign that I didn't care about you. The reason for that was that I didn't want to burden you. And he repeats that. So I refrained and will refrain from burdening you in any way. Under the influence of the false teachers, the Corinthians have chosen to interpret Paul's refusal to take money from them as a sign that he doesn't want any close relationship with them. But it doesn't have to be interpreted that way. The simpler, the more obvious explanation is that he didn't want to be a burden on them. Now, that word, burden, I think that helps us to explain why he was willing to accept money from the Macedonian Christians, but not from the Corinthian Christians. The fact is that the Corinthian Christians would have thought of it as a burden to support Paul financially. You know, I said earlier that we might be willing to accept financial help from a family member. But I should have said, really, from some family members. There are family members you wouldn't ask for help from. I'm thinking about the family member who, when you approach them, looks very superior and says, well, these are difficult times for us all, and it will be a great sacrifice for me, but in the circumstances, I see that I shall have to grant your request. After all, we are relatives. I know my duty. And he makes you feel that you're being a great burden on him. Now, there wasn't a hint of that with the Macedonians. They were just pleading with Paul to take their money. But maybe Paul had picked up the vibes with the Corinthians. Yes, they would be willing to accept him as their client and to support him. But they would never let him forget that they were making a great sacrifice, that he was burdening them. Paul says, I wasn't willing to be a burden to you. I'm not now, and I never will be. As the truth of Christ is in me, this boasting of mine will not be silenced in the region of Achaia. Paul, as a man full of the truth of Christ, makes this solemn vow. He says, it's my boast that I've never burdened you. And I'm going to carry on boasting about that. I never will burden you. As we've said many times, the word boasting doesn't mean bragging proudly. He's simply saying, I'm glad to be able to say that I've never been a burden on you. I've never taken money from anyone who wasn't really happy to give it. I can say that now, and I'm going to carry on saying it and sticking by it. So when I'm in Macedonia, I'll accept the support of churches there because they really see giving as a privilege. But when I'm in Achaia, the region round Corinth, I won't accept your support because I know what you're like. I know the culture of the area. And you think of giving as a burden, don't you? You think of it as the duty that a patron owes to his clients, and which he performs because it would damage his public reputation not to. Do you see how careful Paul's being with his words? He's not attacking them, but he's making it very clear that the problem isn't that he lacks love for them. It's that they lack love for him. He would take support from Christians in Macedonia because they loved him and they really wanted to support him. They see it as a privilege. But he's not going to take support from the church in Corinth or the other churches of Achaia because they would think of it as a burden that they had to carry. Paul says, I'm not going to burden you in any way. So this is the bottom line, verse 11. Why haven't I taken your money? Why have I sworn I never will take your money? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. That's Paul's comfort. The false teachers may make all sorts of false insinuations against Paul. They may say, oh, he doesn't love you. And the Christians in Corinth may choose to believe them. But God knows the reality. Paul can say, God knows that I love you. Sometimes, you know, we've got to be content with that. When other people are reading all sorts of motives into our actions, when people are talking as if they really know what's going on in our hearts, sometimes we have to be prepared to say, well, God knows the truth. And if God approves of what I'm doing and of my motives for doing it, I can't afford to worry about what other people are saying. Other people may say, I don't love you. God knows I do. So, verse 12, what I do, my present policy, I will continue to do. I have to say the rest of the sentence is very difficult to be sure of how it should be translated, difficult to be sure exactly what it means. But I think it means something like this. Paul says, what I do, I will continue to do. I'm going to stick with my present policy. Why? In order to undermine the claim of those who would like to claim. He's talking about the false teachers. They're wanting to make great claims for themselves. They're claiming to be Christ's apostles. They're claiming to be great spiritual leaders. They're claiming to be servants of righteousness. While meanwhile, they're sucking money out of everybody they can. Well, Paul says, I want to undermine their claim. I want to show up their claims as false. And the best way I can do that is by refusing to take money unless it's from people like the Macedonians who really want me to have it. That's the best way for me to expose the greed of these false apostles. He's inviting the Corinthians to compare his willingness to preach the gospel without pay, to work with his hands, to go hungry, with the greed and the self-indulgence of the false teachers. I want, and I'm translating the rest of the sentence literally, I want them to be found out, to be shown up for what they really are, just as we ourselves. Paul's saying, I want the truth about them to be visible. And I want the truth about myself and my colleagues to be visible as well. I want them to be seen for what they are. And I want us to be seen for what we are. He's going to go on in verse 13 to say how cleverly the false teachers have disguised themselves up until now. They're false apostles. They're deceitful workmen. They're disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. But if the Corinthian Christians were really thinking straight, they would see that these greedy men couldn't possibly be true apostles of Christ. They would realize that these men were just out to exploit them. Their attitude to money shows up what they really are. And Paul's attitude to money shows up what he really is. Jesus talked about false teachers, didn't he? And he said, by their fruits you shall know them. He says there'll be visible signs by which we can recognize them. And one of those visible signs again and again will be their attitude to money. Where you have a man or a woman or a so-called Christian group that's constantly making an issue of money, demanding money, putting pressure on people to give money, throwing out hints that they need your money, living a life of luxury on other people's money, you don't have to dig very far into their theology to expose them for what they are. You know already that they're false teachers. They're not messengers of Christ. They can't be. People who are doing who are fulfilling their ministry and meanwhile lining their own pockets, people who are willing to exploit others, cannot be true apostles of Christ. It's a contradiction in terms. The true messenger of Christ is like Paul. If Paul were never paid a penny, he would still be longing to preach the gospel of God. If people said, we're not ever going to give you any support, then he'd have been willing to work as a tent maker all his days, if that was the only way of bringing God's gospel to people. The one thing you can't say about Paul is that he was motivated by money. And Paul says, that's how you know that I'm real. We read at the beginning of the service the words of Jeremiah the prophet, who said that there were times when he said, I'm no longer going to speak in God's name. It's too hard. It's too painful. Causes too much opposition. But he says, I found I couldn't be silent, because the word of God was like a fire burning in my bones. I knew I had God's message, and I couldn't let it burn away inside me. I had to let it out. I had to preach it. Well, that's Paul too. Paul says, woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. He's got to do it. Not because it brings financial rewards. For him, it doesn't. It never did. Just because it was God's gospel. It was this extraordinary saving message that God had sent through Paul to the world. Paul says, I want them to be found for what they are, the false teachers. And I want you to recognize me for who I am, a true messenger of Jesus Christ, bringing the true gospel of God. Innocence is a very attractive feature. It's lovely when you meet Christians who are completely unsuspicious, who always assume that people have the best motives, who never sit in judgment on anyone. But that sort of innocence is for babies. It's naivety. We have to be critical. We have to be willing to say, there are people out there who are liars, con men, fraudsters, false apostles. And one of the ways we'll recognize them is the fact that they want money. And it's obvious that they're doing their work for money. We don't give them the benefit of the doubt. We just say, by their fruits you know them. And equally, there are men out there who are living sacrificially, who are willing to live on the breadline, if only they're allowed to bring the gospel to people. Those are the people we honour. Those are the people we love. Those are the true apostles of Christ. By their fruit you shall know them.